Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, your weekly dose of insider DevOps trends, AWS news, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our SweetOps community, plus a live Q&A that you can't find anywhere else. I'm your host, Eric Osterman. It's April 9th, 2025. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We're a DevOps accelerator for AWS infrastructure, and we help teams who want to deploy their software faster. And we do this by leveraging our over 200 Terraform modules and our reference architecture that ties it all together. So if you or your team has been banging your head against the wall with Terraform, just head over to cloudposse.com/meet. Again, cloudposse.com/meet. Answer a few quick questions and you'll book a meeting with me directly. So how can you maximize today's session? Well, first off, our format is informal. You can engage as much as you'd like, ask questions. And if you're curious about any of our open source tools or modules, go for it. And for those on the recording, we host these calls live, and you can register by going to cloudposse.com/office hours. Again, cloudposse.com/office hours. I do have one ask. If you find any portion of today's session valuable, please share it with your team, spread the knowledge, and look forward to seeing the rest of your team here on Office Hours. So let's jump into what I got on my announcements for today. All right. First one. So this is an interesting one. So Wing or Winglang, many of you probably never even heard of it. It was a really ambitious attempt at rethinking what a modern programming language should be in the age of the cloud. It was a startup founded by one of the original developers behind CDK, so the cloud developer toolkit. I believe that's what stands for, from Amazon. And this was an attempt to rethink it outside of the box. Like, let's start from scratch. Let's not build it on Node. Let's not build it on Python, Java, anything. Let's just create a whole net new language that has all the constructs of what these things mean and then do the translation so you can run it everywhere. On the one hand, you know, I give founders like this credit because they think big. I don't think that big. But unfortunately, it didn't pan out this time, and they are winding down. So Winglang looked kind of like something in between TypeScript and Node, in, you know, or Java programming, but was a totally new language. And you have to implement so much else, including the whole language ecosystem, package ecosystem, module ecosystem that go along with any successful language. I think it's hard to do a language like this venture-backed. We ultimately saw what happened with HashiCorp and Terraform, right? And it was closed source now. Well, not closed source, but BSL license. So, any thoughts on this one? Has anyone looked at it? Oh, interesting. Armand Degar of HashiCorp was one of the investors.
Yeah, I mean, there were a number of investors that invested as part of the fund, like a fund that they raised. But that, I mean, I looked at it, I thought it was interesting, but it seemed a lot like Pulumi to me, like in how it implemented things. So essentially you wrote in their, you know, in their little language, and they had a like a VS Code plugin that would like draw the things as you wrote out, like the constructs that you wanted. Like you'd write, you know, I want a bucket, and then it would like pull up a bucket, and you could interact with that bucket on some layer that ran locally, like a simulator that ran locally on your machine. You know, something similar to like LocalStack or, you know, something along those lines. And then eventually you would compile it, and you'd give it your target, and the target could be like Terraform for AWS, Terraform for Azure, Terraform for GCP, CDK, or the, you know, Terraform for CDK or whatever that thing was called. And it basically was just like boiling it down to those primitives, and then essentially you could deploy it using those other tools. So it was really not even, I mean, it is a language, but it basically transpiles to some other, construct that then deploys it out there.
So
So
really, so it was still transpiling.
yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, well, yeah, I mean, like you had to give it a target. Like I think if you go and look at like how to deploy or whatever, you run, yeah, they say compile, but I'm not really sure that it's a compilation. It seems more like a transpilation to me because it's actually using either Terraform or CDK under the hood. So you're basically like boiling it down to there, and then that's how the whole thing works. I thought it was a pretty lofty goal. Yeah, that's the thing that you could see in like in VS Code if you're using it. It basically had like every time you added a new construct, it would put a little thing like that on it, and you could interact with it in clicking on it and performing tasks against the simulator.
Do you think they're going to pull a Pulumi and start out with Terraform as a back-end kind of thing, and then eventually
Oh,
replace it with?
they announced they're closing the company down.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I guess in the spirit of that was what they were going to go with. I mean.
Yeah, I don't know. Don't know what their end goal was, but the guy, like, his last name is Ben Israel. I forget his first name that founded the thing is, was the guy I think who wrote the AWS, whatever that thing was. The Terraform CDK bridge, basically. Yeah. I can never keep
Oh,
all those
he
names.
works just on that part.
I think he actually built that whole like open source project. Like that was what he built. So, yeah.
All right. So yeah, again, that was shutting down, so don't go running off to try wingling out.
You can still try it out, even though they announced that they're shutting it down. It's still available.
The next one was just something I saw on Hacker News, a friendly reminder that you can override the shell in your GitHub actions. One of the common ways of doing that is the most common shell is, of course, using Bash, and then you're just running script in Bash. But you can use any interpreted language as part of that, and there's a wrapper for C++ to do the same, or C. This is also a common pattern, right, with TypeScript or GitHub script is what I was thinking. Matt, you shared this one with me. Gosh, I guess I was more surprised that you mean this wasn't happening sooner. It sounds like malware has adopted a P2P approach, making it almost impossible now to shut down the sophisticated botnets. And this has now been raised as a national security threat. I guess FastFlux, is my understanding, is that's the technique where the peers are constantly changing, and there's so many of them that you can't just target like a command and control server and shut it down.
Oh yeah, so this is even it's even a little bit further than that. So it leverages DNS. So the whole idea is that the people that are running these botnets are switching the authoritative DNS servers and the actual IP addresses that certain records are resolving so quickly that you can never try to like look them up from the DNS names to then shut down the thing, because by the time you're doing it, it's already changed. So it's like, and then what ends up happening is that because DNS is distributed, it gets distributed all over the world with all different values pointing to all different parts of the botnet. So it's really hard to actually get to try to figure out like where this is all coming from, because like every place you look at it has like different entries kind of distributed everywhere. So it's a pretty pretty sophisticated thing that you'd have to do to run it. So it's pretty
So
interesting.
there's still the single point, or I guess they have also a handful of DNS hosts, but that the authoritative server is being changed. So even if you try and query it, it's no longer authoritative anymore. And then they can have so many of these, and each one, and DNS is so resilient if you're not looking for a for zero interruptions, it's pretty resilient. I remember some of these botnets also were using an algorithm to swap DNS names themselves, for example, in a deterministic manner.
And I think this ties into that, right? So it's constantly, because then you're like, oh, well, let's just go to the registrar and figure out who owns that domain and shut that domain down. So when you do that, it's already switched to a new domain that's hiding behind like the same craziness that's happening this way. So yeah, they're pretty sophisticated.
I mean, it is truly at the point where the only tenable solution, at least in a corporate environment, is allow listing or whitelisting domains. Anything more on that, Matt?
No, I just it came across the article. It seemed pretty, just seemed pretty interesting to me, so I figured I'd forward it along.
So my team's gotten me hooked on Cursor as an IDE alternative for VS Code, and thought that was pretty awesome. I didn't know that I was already in the cool kids doing something called vibing or vibe programming, but I just learned what that term was now. So GitHub is jumping on board with that now. And the frustrating thing, obviously, if you've been using Copilot with VS Code, is that it couldn't, I believe, do any code generation really for you, not across multiple files, at least. So that is now what it supports, and it also has introduced support for a MCP, which is the protocol that allows, I guess, agents to be programmatically controlled. So, any better explanation on this one, Jeremy, Matt?
Yeah, I think the main thing was that they're like agent mode is essentially what allows any model to actually have side effects like in your project that you're using. So where when you're just traditionally using a model, you can provide it context, you can ask it questions, it can give you answers, but it can't actually modify anything or change anything on your behalf. And when you introduce agent mode now can, with your permission or without your permission, depending on the mode and all that kind of thing, make changes on your behalf. So, or as Cursor calls it, YOLO mode, which is kind of a little bit terrifying. But as long, I guess, as long as you use Git and check out a branch before you do it. You should be good.
So one of the interesting things about Cursor YOLO mode versus just regular agent mode. So regular agent mode will make changes to multiple files and then wait for your approval to apply them all. And that can still go across many files. And it can still get crazy and out of hand. But what YOLO mode does is it can execute commands on your behalf, like delete files or like run my tests for me automatically. And you can use things like the Cursor rules to define the acceptance criteria for applying changes. So it can iterate on its own. It can iterate itself. So it can run tests, make sure they pass, run linting, make sure it passes. Then if it doesn't, keep going. So sometimes it can take up to like 15 minutes of just cycling on its own to finally get what it wants.
And tools like Aider and Goose have had this for a while. One thing to be clear on is it works best with AI backends that or models that allow a lot of context. So you'll see folks use things like Gemini 2.5, things that can have a lot of context.
Can you
I had
Gemini with
mentioned it.
Cursor?
Oh yeah.
Can you use Gemini with Cursor?
Yes.
I believe so, yeah. I've used a few different ones. And yeah, as long as the context is large enough, it's usually not, going to break on you.
Yeah, the Gemini had an insane one. I remember we were looking at the comparison. It was like 2.5 megs of context.
Well, and I don't know if you looked at the thing I posted in Office Hours today, but Quantum Alpha, I linked that.
And
That
it looks like
is the new, really, really popular. I think it's probably going to surge past 04 at this point.
Yeah,
If you want, I
I
can
just saw the
post a link
link.
in.
Sorry, there was not enough context around. I'm opening it up now. So, okay, so fill me in on this. What's the deal here?
Or Quasar Alpha. That's interesting thing. So it's a free model on OpenRouter right now that has a million context, and people aren't sure who actually has it actually hosted. So there's theories that it's actually OpenAI doing a stealth AI, and then there's also this company, Silks AI, but it doesn't seem like anybody really knows who is doing it, but it runs at scales that really only OpenAI or a few other companies, maybe Microsoft or the like, could run it at. But
And this isn't getting the kind of attention DeepSeek got when it came out.
it's getting better attention, in my opinion. I think it runs a lot better than DeepSeek did. I've tried it a few times now, and it's actually been fantastic. I gave it I want to say 115K blob of JSON from GitHub, and I said, "Hey, can you help me write some GraphQL to sort through this and fix this one issue?" And it did it very quickly, and explained everything in detail. Didn't have any trouble, ran through some iterations and tests, and I think the final context was at almost 500. And yeah, it was really, really easy to use.
Here's something alluding to what you were saying. New mystery model on OpenRouter is probably OpenAI.
Yeah, folks don't know who it is, but most people are convinced it's just OpenAI releasing a free model that is I think almost self-competing with maybe 04 or 01. I think of the what people are comparing it to.
So, what is it about models that restricts the size of the context window?
Oh, it's part of the memory constraints and what you actually set up the model to use. I've only briefly done it with RunPod, and if you haven't tried RunPod serverless, it's a pretty great way to experiment and learn how all this stuff really works under the hood. I only spent $4, and I tested several things like DeepSeek and Mistral and everything else. But RunPod has a serverless mode for that, and really you find that the context is a part of what memory is free after the model loads for the GPU to run through and have sort of something in the air. It's a part of the conversation that you're building with that agent in this case. So if your repo is really big, like you have a large infrastructure repo, you need a lot more context to make sure that the AI can or the model can have all of that in view. Otherwise, it starts in some cases, if it's set up to just drop it, then it'll just start forgetting stuff. So
Yeah,
you'll
no, I'm
see that
very familiar with
parts
that.
of your repo it forgets,
Yeah. All right.
I posted in chat a link to Cursor's supported models, so if you wanted to see that or anyone wants to take a look at that. As a fast follow on, I thought it was interesting. I saw yesterday, I think it was yesterday or 2 days ago, that Pulumi released their official MCP server. So now you can
Oh.
actually talk to you can talk to and deploy infrastructure from your AI model, which is cool but also terrifying.
Yeah. Interesting.
I'm
And
having a lot of fun with Quinn right now and teaching it to read Atmos outputs. But I don't have anything official, but at some point I would like to get it to where I could ask it questions about what Atmos configures, what it knows, suggestions on components, stuff like that.
was this that AI developer announced last year? Sounded honestly like a flop at the time, but
Oh, Quinn?
yeah, or
I
was
think
I
it's
don't
from.
know.
I think it's from Alibaba. Is that right?
Oh, okay, got it.
I don't remember exactly who, but it's basically a. It's not like a premier kind of model, but it's really easy to run affordably on a local machine, especially the lower bit, like say 30, I think 36 or below bit models. You can run at home for folks who are security conscious.
So in on office hours, we talked about this recently, was that one for Terraform. So like you mentioned the one for Pulumi, here's one for Terraform. I didn't see this. Oh, crates is a way of distributing it then, right? Because it's, is it Rust or
Yeah,
R?
crates are Rust,
Yeah.
like package management.
Got it.
It goes with Cargo, the package manager.
I just remember seeing that with Tembo, how they distribute a lot of their plugins or something.
Yeah, I thought the interesting part about the Pulumi one is that it's official, like it's from
Yeah,
Pulumi and it's,
exactly.
yeah.
No, this is obviously not official and experiment. All right. Next announcement was, well, as we all know, Chef went end of life recently. Now there is a fork of that called Sync, as in Sync is not Chef. And
Is that like YAML?
yeah, exactly. A recursive acronym. And then the last one was, I thought it was more interesting just because us who released it. It's Zapier. So Zapier, obviously using Terraform, Zapier being the 10-year predecessor to N8N, Nathan, or similar services like Make, running probably pretty extreme scale. Oh, looks like this is actually was started several years ago, only recently updated some nominal file there. The gist of it was, if you wanted to use Terraform Cloud in a Atlantis kind of way, where you apply before merge, this allowed you to do it. There's a huge debate going. A huge debate is an exaggeration, but there's an ongoing debate always in Terraform and the Terraform community, started by Atlantis, is like, should you apply before merge or after merge? And there are pros and cons with both, but we all know you should apply after merge, right? Just kidding. Well, that's what we do. So TF Buddy helps you do that with Terraform Cloud.
Or maybe it doesn't, because that predates all the license changes, right?
Well, this is for Terraform Cloud.
I know, but
But
I'm not sure that they let you do everything anymore. Well, I guess they probably still do. You still have access to the API.
and this assumes, I mean, I assume you're probably paying for Terraform Cloud at this point, and this is not doing anything, remotely violating the terms of service for that. This is just, orchestrating the flow differently than Terraform Cloud does out of the box. So this is not an alternative for Terraform Cloud. This is literally working with Terraform Cloud. That's all I got. Let's check out the chat. Oh, there's the Pulumi MCP server. Interesting. Cool. Is there a cloud formation?
Oh, like an official one? I don't know.
Eight of us labs. So it implements.
The cost analysis one is pretty interesting. Like, tell me how much it will cost to deploy this.
That's cool. I'll add that to the chat in case anyone's interested. Thought it stopped doing that thing in Zoom where the last bot to message you owned the recent conversation. Thought they stopped doing that, but now that's happening again.
Still amazed at how committed Amazon and Amazon Labs is to Python. Like, especially to distribute like things that are meant to run on all different platforms across like, their entire customer base.
When they came out with AWS CLI V2, I was so disappointed seeing that it was again in Python and
Yeah.
not like a at least a cross-compiled binary that's easy to install.
No, they embed the Python runtime in it, which is like even crazier.
You can't, and it's still only available via an installer, I believe. You can't just download the binary for that, even though it embeds the, like, I got excited when I saw it. That it was supposed to be self-contained in that extent, but then unexcited just as quickly when I still couldn't
Yeah.
call a binary.
Yeah, one would expect that if all you're doing is connecting APIs, what really is the reason why Python is primary choice?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of funny because I noticed it because the commands to run all these things are running UVX, and like UV is basically the new package manager to replace pip and all that, but it's written in Rust. So they wrote like there's a whole package manager for Python now written in Rust that,
Yeah.
I mean, they're like all package managers pretty much are written in some other like language, like NVM and Yarn and all that kind of stuff are also like written in C or Rust or whatever they're written in, but like I don't know, they started from like UVX is like the NPX equivalent where you can just run a Python package like from and it will like find it from the registry and run it. Yeah, what's that whole thing that it's called that it's part of? Like Astral or something? I forget the whole thing. Yeah.
I learned something new.
So this is all like a basically like a Rust layer on top of on top of Python. Or I guess Rust written tools to support Python. Yeah, and there you go. Single tool for pip tools, pipx, poetry, pyenv, virtualenv, whatever.
Whatever happened to just having a wheel house in your S3 bucket?
Didn't spend that much time with Python to get the reference.
Just a way to make it really, really fast to install things.
Well, are there any questions we can get answered today on the call? This is the part of office hours that's totally open-ended. And who raised their hand there? Oh, Michael, of course, you always come with good questions.
Yes, indeed. I really appreciate you guys for, at the very least, being a sounding board for people who are going through it with their infrastructure developers, whatever the case may be. So yeah, I come to you this week with a very interesting, but maybe not so uncommon problem. Very quick overview of the architecture. It's a web application. Front end is publicly accessible. Back end running on EC2 is not exposed to the internet. However, the backend application has a web interface component to it. So the devs need to connect to it to configure the thing, right? So I'm like, well, you can do AWS client VPN. That's $5 per hour plus data. You could do AWS Workspaces secure browser. That's $7 per month per user. Or you could do some sort of like, maybe an EC2 instance connection endpoint, Bastion host, SSH tunnel using AWS SSM or something like that, you know. So I know there's a lot of options out there, but before I start reinventing the wheel, I just wanted to bounce off the group to see if anyone had encountered a similar scenario, and what approach did you use for it to basically get a local web browser to access a private EC2 like web page or ALB even.
Yeah, so I mean, and the one option I didn't hear mentioned was that ALBs support native OAuth, I think, or OIDC rather.
Oh, okay.
So then you can just connect OIDC authentication with that, and I guess you would still need a separate. You probably need a separate load balancer, or I don't know if it could just.
Yeah, because the caveat being the load balancer serving the web app is internal. It's You
private,
just put
so.
it, you just put it on a path, basically.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Yeah, you can do that. Or my other suggestion is you can use API Gateway, Ah, okay.
potentially to do that as well. Unless you need, it depends what you need for that. Like if that web app has WebSockets, then you might be out of luck depending on
No, it's
what the
all pretty much
requirements are.
just HTTP requests. You know, they gotta get to a browser, log into the thing, set the configurations, and then exit. And then the app just kind of does its thing.
Yeah, you could definitely use you could use the you could use Cognito to authenticate ALBs if you need to. You could also, the other thing I didn't hear you mentioning out there with all those things is just like, you know, throw up an Nginx box somewhere and reverse proxy it, and you can do anything you want with authentication. At that point, there's a ton of ways to solve this problem. But the ALB is
Yeah.
definitely the simplest one if you can, if that works for you.
Yeah, the ALB route is pretty easy to set up. We did this for a demo application that we wanted one of our potential clients to see. And I just and we use Entra ID for SSO in our organization. So I invited them as a guest into our Azure organization and gave them permissions to the application through intro groups and just configured OIDC on the load balancer. And it's pretty quick and easy to do, and that works well. But also the SSH tunnel approach works really well and is pretty reliable and very cheap compared to running VPN clients. And I've done this at a couple companies where we needed access to a database in AWS. And then we didn't want to open up VPN connections or configure VPN for contractors or other people. So we just put together a shell script that checks for environment variables to make sure their proper profile is configured in AWS. And you can now it's easy to generate this stuff with tools like Cursor, where you can actually add all the information you need into their AWS config file to get them to connect. And configure everything on their end from just one running one command and stand up the SSH tunnel. And
Yeah,
so
that's really kind of what like an approach I'd hope to get to kind of localize it to the person who needs to connect, as opposed to a, you know, a larger infrastructure thing that's going to have to live for an extended period of time, because it's not something that they're going to have to do often. You know, you stand up the app, you log in, you configure it, and then you bounce. It's not something that needs to be persistent. The one caveat with these EC2 instances, I did like all the security is like no SSH, so you do have to use AWS SSM start session if you're connecting from your local system or you know from the console or whatever. But if I understand correctly, and I think I've done this before, even it's just probably been a while, you can create tunnels using AWS SSM sessions. It would just, I just would have to figure that out to, you know, figure out how to create the tunnel using the session to get to the, basically port 80 or port 8000, wherever, you know, the app's running on.
Yeah, I can get your contact info. I can share you the bash script that I put together for this. It's
Yeah, that'd
not
be
anything
awesome.
IP specific to our company, but it essentially does this. The one thing you have to have done on the AWS side is you have to have the EC2 instance already set up with the there's an AWS managed IAM profile. I think it's SSM Core or something like that. So you have to attach that to the instance you want to connect to. And what I've been doing is in our CI environment, that's just used for internal development, so there's no customer data in it, is I just use our ECS. We only have like a one or two node ECS cluster, and then I just let the SSM tunnels go over those ECS nodes. So
Okay.
we already have EC2 servers that are up and running, so there's no need to stand up a new server just for this SSM based tunnel. And as long as you have the SSM permissions set up for that server, and the users have the right permissions as well to use it, then everything's fine.
Cool. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, and just for the completeness on the ALB solution, if you choose that, basically you just set up an ALB, you give it a path, and then have that rewrite the slash admin path to your backend host that you're looking for, and then you authenticate it with OIDC, and you can use like GitHub as your OIDC provider. If you want. So like, since everyone has a GitHub request, basically you could make it so that like only certain people in certain GitHub groups or within certain GitHub scopes can access your endpoint there. So it's fairly easy, kind of a one-time setup, and you don't have to deal with it. With the SSM Connect stuff, not that I want to get like too deep here, but there's a bunch of stuff you have to do to harden your host to make sure that all these people that you're allowing access over this tunnel can't do things that you don't want them to do on that host, you know, that they can only run that that application. So if you don't want them to be able to run commands or like access the AWS metadata endpoint as an example, et cetera, et cetera. You have to take a lot of other hardening steps to make sure that doesn't happen. So the ALB is definitely simpler and poses less of a security risk than letting people get onto the box itself. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, at the moment, these are all like admin level folks, and they're writing the code, so they'd be the ones, connecting. But yeah, I mean, down the road, as far as like an operational,
Yeah.
outlook to it would be better to have a little bit more control over, who's connecting, what they could do, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, and the that was actually going to be my other suggestion, Eric. I think you just also Googled what I was going to say. But two things: if you're in any kind of compliance and environment and you need like separation of concerns and all of that, letting them onto the box probably not a good thing. And then I was going to also recommend that Cloudflare has the agent that you can use. It's basically agentless VPN that allows you to connect to that over the Cloudflare network with authentication. So that
And
would
the
also be another thing.
Cloudflare thing, you can do it even without that That you can now set it up just on a free, like they just generate a random host for you. Since you said this is like a one-time deal where you set things up and you don't really need it ongoing, maybe just using the Cloudflare gtunnel is a very low lift.
Yeah, that could be cool too.
Since you don't even need a Cloudflare API key or anything.
Looks like Sam has a question.
And see, hey Sam.
Hey, I've been asking questions in Slack, but I thought it could be helpful to hop on this call and talk about it anyway.
Yeah, for sure.
So I'm new to Atmos, but not new to Terraform. What I have recently was inheriting a Terraform repo where there aren't even modules, but has different tenants in GCP. So I'm trying to make an effort to, I want to refactor that or just rewrite it. So far we have like one tenant in GCP with multiple projects, multiple environments, whatever you want to call it. And while I'm reading the docs and looking, and like writing out proof of concepts, my questions are like, where in the abstraction do I need to be careful about in terms of designing it if I might not get it right on the first try, which I probably won't. And
Yeah, well, so I think there, what we can do is a couple things. One, I can show you kind of how we organize things, and that can give you some ideas. Two, I don't know if you've seen this section under Learn for design patterns that show you some of the different ways we've organized configuration over the years. The right strategy kind of depends on your organizational concerns and what you're trying to achieve. So I don't think there's a universal way to organize everything, but you'll see a lot of these different write-ups here. Let me show
Yeah,
you how.
those docs have been very helpful.
Okay.
I've basically structured out the folders so far, and I'm starting to put in one or two test components and stacks. I haven't gone as far as executing them yet. Probably sometime this week.
This folder is public or yeah, so here's this one is public this repo, so you can take a look at this. This is kind of a mock Terraform repository. It has all these components in here. Like API, cache, CDN, but if you look at them under the hood, they don't do anything. They just use a bunch of random resources to simulate an environment, so it's easy to play with it locally. And then it defines some stack configurations under orgs, and then it's organized into two OUs. I think these would be like projects or similar to projects in GCP.
Not
No,
necessarily.
no, no. These, no. So the, yeah, folders and projects. So these would be like folders, and then you go into this folder, and then you have these projects, for example.
Yeah, that's very similar to how I'm imagining it. I'll take a look at this specific example. Longer term, but go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna add one thing to kind of. Not that I want to negate anything that Eric said. I mean, I've been a big part of like helping to design this, all these other things. But at the end of the day, the way that your folders are structured don't really matter too much. That's mostly just for day to day. How do you most logically think about where to go to look to find your code? So whatever works for your team, is the right way to organize it. Like whatever is organized and your team finds it easy to understand that if I'm looking for, the, whatever, the blob storage bucket that's located in the dev account, for in the East region, you can grok that and then know which folder to go to find that. It doesn't really matter how you actually organize the code as long as you have a way that makes sense to you. Then, like at the end of the day, it all sort of merges into a flat configuration of like actual components that are being deployed to a particular place. And once it gets deep merged, it has all the information it needs to deploy it to a certain place. So, like how you put it in folders doesn't really matter at the end of the day. So, I mean, not that I
Oh,
wanted to negate
like
it.
file system folders, just for the lack of, just for disambiguation.
It's basically just like folders of folders, however it makes sense for you guys to organize it. So point being, you can't really screw that up. You can always refactor that without actually changing what happens to the components, by just changing where you import things from and et cetera, et cetera. The more important thing is just how you decompose your monolithic Terraform pieces that you have into modules and other root components, et cetera. That's by far the harder the harder task than figuring out how you want to organize your YAML files in Atmos. So hopefully that makes sense and I didn't throw you too far off by what I was saying.
No, that was great. I think that helps validate a lot of what I've gotten from the docs. To hear people talk about that. I was gonna say longer term, we want to manage things besides GCP or cloud service providers of Terraform. Like we have our CNAPP. We have our CI/CD platform. So I know there are mentions of like having a monorepo for all this code. Does that extend to other tools like a CNAPP? Does that make sense to be in the same repo?
It's
Sure.
a it, yeah it, it's a, yeah so let's or this is not where I want to go, but so a few options, and what the right answer is ultimately going to be, like, A, the size of your organization, how many people are involved with this, what trade-offs you want to make, because with every solution there are trade-offs, right? So you can go with the mono repo approach, and if you did that, the way, for example, one way of thinking about it is, you see here how we have this concept of orgs. You could think about one org representing one cloud. So you could have GCP under here, you could have AWS under here, you could have your CNAPPs under here, you could have things organized that way, if it makes sense. If, like, for imagine, you're 10,000 person organization with thousands of engineers or hundreds of engineers, and GitHub and a monorepo might not be the best or ideal solution for that. And you might want to have separation of concerns at the repository level and then break those down by, say, cloud. So you can have a monorepo per cloud, a monorepo for AWS, a monorepo for GCP, a monorepo for your data centers or something like that. The reuse between clouds is minimal. So the driver to keep it all in one repo is lessened. It's when you want, it's, often with a monorepo, some of the benefits come when there's a lot of reuse within the code base there. So, like, if you're on AWS, you're deploying lots of different products, and those products have consistently databases and clusters and buckets and IAM roles. It's great that you can reuse all of those components that you write, but you're not going to use an S3 bucket on GCP, right? So there's no reuse there. The other things to bear in mind, and this is what I wanted to show in Atmos, is
While you're looking that up, can I make one other comment? So I think that your ability to use a monorepo also largely comes down to the tooling that you have around it in order to operate in the monorepo, especially as it comes to CI and CD, like of your Terraform out of there. So I think a lot of it has to do with like how you're deploying all this stuff. And do you have tools that help you detect what has changed with each pull request and and all of those things. And while Eric, you definitely, I agree with you definitely that, you don't have a lot of reuse behind them. One of the other things that a monorepo is also very helpful for is it's coordinated like releases where everything is released at the same version. And if you're doing multi-cloud and you have the same application, for example, running across multiple clouds for redundancy in very large organizations, it is often very useful to be able to do a single pull request that deploys a version or updates some infrastructure related to a new version of an application or a service or something like that that is being deployed to multiple clouds. And then you have your CI/CD infrastructures that then orchestrate that to get it deployed to all of the different clouds. So my only point being, make sure you have a reason for wanting all of your multiple clouds in a single monorepo. And if you do, and make sure you have good tooling to support it and pipelines that can deploy it and do the right thing without like, so for an example, if you make a change to one bucket in GCP, you don't want your AWS, Azure, CloudFormation, I mean Cloudflare and Akamai clouds to all play in all of their things just because you made one little change in GCP. You want to have like context-aware pipelines that make sure that only the smallest things are being changed every time you do a release out of the monorepo. So lots of considerations there. So just I know I'm somewhat rambling, but just wanted to give you like some thoughts behind monorepo across cloud and where it may and may not make sense.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
So the thing I wanted to look up was just this. What we recently added in Atmos, and you don't need to configure anything to use it. It's enabled by default, which is if you set the GitHub token or the Atmos GitHub token, anytime Atmos tries to fetch something from GitHub, such as an import or vendoring, it will set the bearer token for GitHub so that you can make those authenticated requests to other repositories in your organization, provided your token has the scope to do so.
Okay, is that specific to GitHub? Like for transparency, we're not on GitHub. We're in Azure DevOps, which is still Microsoft, but
No, we did recently add GitLab and Bitbucket. Azure DevOps wasn't in that, but if Azure DevOps has something similar, we would not be opposed to adding that. If you just point us to what those variables are, it's easy. The other thing is that you're on Azure DevOps, so we don't have any turnkey workflows for you, but if you were on GitHub, we do have our GitHub Actions, of course, for Atmos and how we've implemented those.
Yeah, I saw a lot of work done for AWS and GitHub Actions. That's great. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to s
These
steer the
work,
whole org.
yeah, these work on, so we have, I believe there is support for Google and Azure, even though we don't maybe thoroughly document that. Community members have contributed support for Google Cloud and Azure, I believe.
You mean within the GitHub Actions?
Yeah, within GitHub Actions, not for Azure DevOps or anything.
Okay. I wonder if we can use GitHub Actions in Azure DevOps.
I don't think so, yeah, unfortunately.
I recently found out they have the GitHub Advanced Security. They deploy that in Azure DevOps.
Oh, they do.
So we use that the same way that you demonstrated in GitHub.
Yeah, so interesting, Azure DevOps. I would have expected by now they would have made an announcement that it's moving into GitHub Actions, but maybe they will continue to keep them entirely separate products.
Yeah, who
Well.
knows? But definitely appreciate talking through some of this. So far, it's just me working on a lot of this
Okay.
in a very traditional org. So sometimes a lot of it's just spinning in my head.
Yeah, I
It's great to
know.
get it
That's
out.
why we th these office hours are perfect for that, rubber ducking or whiteboarding.
Yeah,
Thanks for that, Eric.
to your previous comment, Eric, I think it's fair to say that Azure DevOps and GitHub Actions are really like a Venn diagram of one another, and there's only like maybe a third overlap from each of them, I would say, or something along the lines. They both have significant feature non-parity, I guess, on to each other. So I think that and I think that Microsoft also generates a significant amount of revenue from Azure DevOps too. So I don't know that they would just roll that into GitHub, but different business units, different, all sorts of things. So it'd be
I get
interesting.
So you're saying I shouldn't keep holding my breath?
I don't know. Maybe they eventually it gets there, but I'm just saying I can see why it just wasn't an easy decision on their part. It wasn't like they bought Jenkins, right? And then they just said, "All right, we're just going to make Jenkins stuff just run in GitHub Actions." I think it's pretty clear like that's like a 90% parity in features or something like that. I think there's just far less total parity between the two other products, in my opinion.
Fair enough. Oh, what is this? You can run a GitHub action in Azure DevOps using the following commands. Huh, that's a little bit convoluted. All right. It's actually triggering it via the API. That's not what we meant. All right. We are at time for today, folks. Thank you for joining. We will be sending out a recording of this session to our YouTube channel. So check that out if there's anything you want to go back and refer to. So that's at youtube.com/cloudposse. If you're curious about getting any help from Cloud Posse or how we can help move the needle at your organization, go to cloudposse.com/meet and you'll book a meeting with me directly. And let's see. Here's some follow-up items if you want to get more involved in our community. There's our Slack community at slack.cloudposse.com. We have our podcast, which is just a syndication of our office hours. And if you haven't registered for office hours, you can go to officehours.com, sorry, cloudposse.com/office hours. Again, cloudposse.com/office hours. Thanks everyone for your time today. See you next week.